am a recovering co-tenant.
Hi, Mary.
It's really wonderful to be here, and thank you, David, the committee, and all the volunteers, everybody who put this on. It's a lot of work. I remember early on when we would put on the conferences for the Dakota National, and especially the things that we were doing just locally in Phoenix in the beginning. You know, it takes everybody pitching in and doing it. That's how it happens. And so I agree, service work is the best place to grow. I remember when I first got into recovery, I'm also a recovering alcoholic and addict, and somebody had said that if you want to really grow, get in a relationship. And if you want to really grow on CODA, get service work. It's really amazing. The rewards are great. I wanted to talk a little bit first. Ken and I realized yesterday, which was kind of interesting, we had lived in San Mateo for not quite a year, 25 years ago. And it was this week that we were on our way moving here. Ken had already lived here, and he drove back to Phoenix to get myself and my children, and we were on the road to San Mateo 25 years ago, and this is where the inspiration for CODA came from. We saw the movie Gandhi here, walked out and over the bay and sat there and talked about that was, if one person could make that kind of difference, that was something that we wanted to do. And so that's where the original inspiration for CODA came from, which was just amazing. And we hadn't even realized all this time. I mean, of all the weeks, of all the, you know, times that it would be. So it's kind of cool. Sure put a lot of work to our heart. You know, Ken and I talked about what we wanted to share about with love versus fear, and we're both going to take turns sharing about that. But in my own recovery, I came out of a family that was, you know, like a lot of our families, extremely dysfunctional. There was a lot of abuse in the family. There was violence. There was, neglect and abandonment. I mean, there's everything that creates codependence. That was in my family, and I learned how to react to that by going away. I would hide under my bed. I'd sneak out my window at night. I would, instead in that fight or flight that tends to come out of our reactions with codependence, I did the flight. That was my way of doing things. And so I was always running away. I was the youngest in my family. I was supposed to be the boy of the family, so I was very much into every sport you could name, and tried to be that son for my dad who was the coach, and you know, everybody loved him in our community, and you know, but nobody knew him inside the house. And that man is, he's my father right now, is dying, and we've had such a strained relationship. Because he had incested me for a number of years while I was growing up, and he never was willing to deal with that with me. And so, you know, looking at this whole process, I had to get to a place of working through all my issues, and CODA saved my life. Ken and I started it quite selfishly because we needed a place to go and to be able to heal. And we weren't able to do that in our other programs because they were meant for that. And so CODA gave me a place where I could come in and start working the steps on all my issues, and especially on this issue that I have with my father. And today I can go see him. We're still not close. We still don't talk about it. But I can go be there and be present for his process of transition right now. And to me, that is a miracle. I didn't think that would ever be something that could truly happen. So I very much was what I consider a fear addict. I took that toxic shame that came out of the things that I experienced growing up, became afraid of ever experiencing it again, and was, control, manage, and manipulate my whole life, and stayed in fantasy. And absolutely was far away from any kind of love, although I thought I was a loving person. I used love and manipulation and being nice and all those different things in order for people not to leave me and to not hurt me. But it was not anything that was truly coming from a place of love within myself. And so I stayed in a lot of fantasies, had lots of expectations built around my fantasies as to how all of you were supposed to act and be. And if you didn't measure up to that, then I was gone. That was my way of doing things. And so my recovery from codependence has been to stay put, if that makes sense. Stay in my body, which was always a challenge. And anybody who Ken knows probably more than anybody. I'm good at leaving my body at times. But I had to learn how to stay put in my body. And so part of that I did after initially going through and working the steps on my codependence is I worked the steps on fear. And that's a little bit what I wanted to talk about it, because that was such a big component of my codependence. I had to go through and really look at all the ways that I still, even after being, because that was probably 5-6 years into recovery from codependence when I did this, and so even after that amount of time and dealing with a lot of those issues, how fear still controlled my life. CODA had been started by then, and we were heavily involved in service work, and, you know, as any of you are in service work, you know, everybody, you know, we sort of became everybody's moms and dads. And so if that was either a loving thing or not so loving thing. And I had reactions to that over and over and over again because I didn't understand. I thought, oh my gosh, we're supposed to all be in CODA and working together and, you know, this kind of fantasy type of thing. Instead of looking at, okay, wait a minute, we're all here to heal. This isn't about blissfulness. And that's where I had to get real with myself that life is ever evolving, you know, and that was a huge message for me, and that part of growth and new growth and regrowth is that it's always breaking free and breaking free of the ground, and there's struggle and there's beauty in that, there's reaching for the sunlight, there's all sorts of wonderful, wonderful experience of life, and that's what life is about. Life isn't about that I'm happy all the time and at peace all the time. Life is about that I'm always growing. You know, that is the one thing that I came to know in recovery is that change is the only absolute. Change is the only absolute. And so I can go through and love myself and love the process, or I can stay resistant with it and fearful with it and try and control it. And it took me a while, but I gradually started going more and more into loving
healing arts.
experience. One I hope I don't ever have to repeat, but I grew more in that year than in quite a while in my recovery. It pushed every tool that I had learned in recovery got challenged, and I had the choice on a daily basis for that whole year as to what I was going to do with that choice. Nothing was ever the same. We bought a piece of property that had, I think it totaled up between $250,000 and $300,000 worth of undisclosed items that we had to fix, and then the real estate market fell. Last August, all of that accumulated to a place that we even ended up filing bankruptcy, which we never thought we would ever be in a place that we would need to do that. We were always very responsible with money and just never thought that would ever happen. But it did. It did. You know, we went over as therapists, and that's what we thought we were going to be doing over there. We ended up being laborers. We dug ditches. We repaired things. We learned how to do construction work. Kim knew how. I had no clue. Nobody wanted me doing too much of it, but I'm dyslexic, so everybody would say, put the wire here, and I'd be over here. So that didn't work too well. But I could. I learned how to make avocado smoothies. If anybody ever tells you that's a good thing, don't try it. And just a quick story on that, because it was so precious. We had a friend of ours from Phoenix who came over to help us out, and somebody had told us about these smoothies. So I made three big glasses of it, and I said, "Here, you guys, try the smoothies." I made them up, and so they're sitting there drinking them. Good codependents they are. Didn't say a word. And I picked mine up and drank it, and I went, "Oh my God, that's horrible." And they said, "Well, you worked so hard at it." So, that's pretty funny. So we keep coming back. You know, I don't think any of us are ever recovered. I think codependence is about our human condition, and what a lovely thing we are is human beings, you know. I mean, how amazing is that? And so Hawaii, we came back. We, you know, are back in Phoenix now and restarted our business that we had, which will be 20 years old in February, which is pretty amazing. But it's been such a transition. We have 5 grandkids now, so we're on to this whole new generation of children, and we have one of our children get married just last month. We have another, the last one, getting married in March, you know, and it's like we're both present. I'm present for seeing my kids go through what they're going through and being present for my grandkids as they're growing up in their lives. And the oldest one, in another year and a few months, is going to be driving. It's like, oh my God, she was just a baby, you know. And here she is in, you know, a year and a half, and she's going to be driving. And so it goes by so fast. And what a joy it is. Codependence recovery gave me back everything I ever desired in life. Bottom line. You know, had I not done this work, had I not gone through, and my work was not a necessarily pretty process, because I was such a control freak and I was so reactive at times, that I had to go through and struggle a lot in order to surrender. And it took me a year to do my first step. For those of you who have done first steps, it was a long time that I did that, and then I finally surrendered. I could acknowledge my powerlessness. I still felt I had some control around my unmanageability, and that was the biggest piece for me. So it's brought me to a place to where my life is fulfilling today, no matter what's going on. Even when we were digging ditches in Hawaii, you know, and experiencing all of that, it was life. It was life. And, you know, each day Ken and I would sit down and we'd talk about how we were feeling about everything, what was going on, what we needed to do to keep ourselves centered. And we would do that every single day because we knew that we were in a stressful time and that we needed the tools of recovery even more so. And they were there. Thank God they were there. It's something that with all of us here today, we all support each other. We encourage each other just by our presence being here. Just being willing to look at ourselves and be able to put one foot in front of the other and celebrate our victories and celebrate our growths, you know, and stay in that place of love and celebration. So I'm guessing I've probably been about a half hour, and so I'm going to have Kim come up here, but I thank you so much. Thank you again for inviting us and for the time here. Bless you all. And I will introduce Ken. His nickname is Nuggle Bunny. Anybody who wants to call him that?
Yes.
Because he.
Thank you, Nuggle Bunny. Now I regress to about 10 years old. I don't know if you can you hear me? Okay. We may need some volume. Is that better?
That's better. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Breathe. Sometimes these are intimidating, you know, especially for a 12-year-old. Which is about how old I feel. I woke up this morning, I looked in the mirror, and I went, oh, that's it. I haven't seen one in years, and I was supposed to speak here this morning, and that's it. Thanks, God. What's that mean?
Need some help there, fella?
I think it's that microphone is the one that maybe works.
There we go.
Is this working?
Yes.
Is this working?
Yes.
Stereo. Good morning, I'm Ken, and I'm a grateful recovering codependent.
Hi, Ken.
And that was it. David, I want to thank you. I want to thank the committee for, we know the tremendous work that it takes to put on a conference, and we are honored to be asked to come and speak. I speak for Mary as well. It's a delight to be here. It's a delight to be a part of this event, and it's a blessing to me to come share my experience, my strength, my hope, and to experience a lot of others' experience, strength, because I can't do it on my own. I tried doing that for years and years and years. But being a good codependent, I thought I could maintain, control, manage, manipulate, avoid people, places, and things, and be okay. As a result, I lost 3 marriages, almost 4. Interesting, Mary had mentioned that 25 years ago this week, we started our relationship. We moved to San Mateo, moved in together, and when the honeymoon was over, which was probably a week, insanity hit. And that was becoming my 4th marriage, and I believe that I was fundamentally incapable of having a loving relationship. And at that point, yet having been in the field, working in the field for about 7 years, been in recovery for the same amount of time, I had no idea I was afraid. I was everything else but afraid, because men don't. Men are not afraid. Men don't cry. Men get angry. Men cover everything up. But in my system, men don't do fear and they don't do tears. And so in Mary's system, women do fear and tears and they don't do anger. So it's a perfect match. And we have a subconscious agreement. I'll do your anger for you. You do my fear and you do my tears. And looking back in the history of my relationships, that was always there. There was always a perfect symmetry to the insanity and the disease, and there's a perfect symmetry to recovery. I couldn't fit with anybody who wouldn't allow me to do their anger for them. If they were going to do angry, and if they were going to do anger towards me, then I would have married my mother. And I couldn't tolerate that. Just very quickly and briefly, I'm a victim of incest and emotional abuse and spiritual neglect and physical violence. of sexual abuse as well as incestual sexual abuse. A profound abandonment. I was raised in a family system where my job was to do the anger and you get punished for it. And when I made the picture look bad enough, they sent me away. And I didn't live at home from the time I was 8 years old on, because they had the money to keep me out of the picture. My roles were primarily the identified problem in the family, the identified patient, the clown, the caretaker, the fixer, the rebel, the reactor, and their job was to look good. I came from a fairly high-profile family in Santa Monica, and they were in the papers all the time. And when I came home, we all disappeared. The family sort of disappeared for a little while until I was gone, because I made the picture look bad. So I didn't live at home. I lived in. I have a career of being thrown out of schools, 8 of them, because I didn't know how to contain anger. I had no idea that my rage was really had nothing to do with a real feeling, because rage is not a feeling. It had to do with pain and shame and fear and loneliness and outrage and sadness and tons of toxic shame. I had no sense of self-worth. The only way I could cover it up was through anger. By the time I was 17, I had my first child, and I've been raising kids ever since. And now we're raising, well, we're not raising them, but we get, it's kind of nice being grandparents. Well, when the first one was born, I was in shock. It was like, I got codependent. What do grandparents look like? Do I have to buy a walker? I had no idea, I had no sense of what it would be like to be a grandparent. And no sense the images in my head were my grandparents, and I wasn't going to be like them. It's been a wonderful discovery, finding out what being a grandparent is. And one of the most delightful aspects is you get to give it back. We're done here. Here's your kids back. We sure love them, but take them home. Part of the gift of being a grandparent for me has been to watch my kids look at me seriously and say, "You never let us do that." And for me to be able to look them in the eyes and say, "I didn't know I could. I thought I needed to control you. I thought that's what parenting was all about, because that's all I got." So out of all those experiences, two things became dominant for me. One is I had a death wish. And they told me I would not live to be 29, that alcohol and drugs would kill me within the next 4 months if I didn't stop using them. And so I didn't realize that I had such self-hatred and such fear and such toxic shame that I simply wanted to die. And I got clean and sober. I'd already lost 2 marriages, 2 homes, 2 sets of, you know, fantasies about the house, the car, and the kids, and 2.5 kids, as a matter of fact, according to statistics. But I had already lost 2 of those, and I was 28, almost 29. And I got clean and sober. I tried another marriage for 18 months without the aid of alcohol, drugs, rage, and violence. And that's why it lasted 18 months. And then I got married. And we moved here, and the insanity started. And when I look back at it all, I think the deepest issue and the deepest concern for me has been always fear. Fear of thousands of fears. And I was given an assignment by a therapist, and I needed to track my fears for 2 or 3 days. And I didn't think I had any until I realized that fear was only one word. I had lots of concerns. I had lots of things that I was nervous about. I had lots of things I was anxious about. I had other things that I was afraid of. I even had other things that I was scared of. I had other things that I was panicked about. And there were things that I had fear about. Now, fear was only one word of all those other words that describe varying degrees of fear. And I really got it. It's like, oh, yeah. Well, a little bit of fear
is concerned, I'm not afraid, I'm just concerned. I'm not overly concerned about it. I'd say, so you're scared? No, I'm just concerned. But I was, fear, but I had to take an honest look at it. When I got done with one-liners, I had three legal pages, legal pad pages full of one-liners. At least 200 things at that moment I had some form of fear about. And then I went into shock. And that scared me. Absolutely terrible. Because for the first time in my life, I realized I had to admit I was afraid. And until that time, I didn't know I was afraid. I thought there was something, as I said, fundamentally wrong with me, but I didn't know I was afraid. And to think that I was afraid that I was weak, small, it brought up every bit of toxic shame. And I had no idea what love actually was. Although I use the word a lot, I had no idea, I had no way to understand it. And so I began to work the steps on fear. And we've done it many times. Basically, those three pages became my first step, and I began to recognize I really am powerless, I am insecure, and that I live in fantasy day in and day out, because no fear is ever real. It's always a fantasy about what might happen in the next moment, the next day, the next month, and the next year. So I was living an imagined life. I was living in fantasy about what you thought of me, how you felt about me, what you might do, what you might say, what you might think. I was living in fantasy about the person I saw in the mirror. Every fear is fantasy driven. So to not live in fantasy and live in the real world meant, okay, behind the fear there's a tremendous amount of pain because it hurts to live in fear. And I don't care how much I wanted to deny that. If I took a little boy and set him over here and I walked over and scared him, he would also hurt. I scared me. I still do sometimes today. I got this voice up here that goes, don't do that, don't sell my set. No, don't sit there, don't say that, no, turn this way, put this, close, close, are you kidding me? No, do this. This committee up here, in some programs they call it the shitty committee, meets in my head at any given moment and controls who, what, where, when, and how I'm going to be. That was the only internal self-parent I had. It's called a critical parent. And that's all I knew, was how to keep me under control, which is what was done to me as a child. And so this critical parent, its sole job is to keep me secure, keep me safe. If it has to scare me, if it has to shame me, if it has to judge me. And then I began to look at the various categories of fear, such as projections and expectations. And I got buried under this for a while, because I couldn't believe the various ways and that I would scare myself, that I would judge myself, shame myself. And I recognized that, yes, I was totally powerless and my life was unmanageable at any given moment, as soon as that part of me kicked in to try to make me secure. And what I come to believe today is that there is absolutely no security anywhere, ever. No matter what my fear, what I try to do to keep me, quote, safe. And we all run around with clutter. We close our windows and lock them at night. We lock the doors and check, make sure that if somebody wants in my house, they're going to get in my house. My only concern is it'll make it difficult enough to where they make enough noise to wake me up and call the police. But if they want in my house, they're going to get in my house. So I can either fear that. And there's been a few times that I thought I heard things, and I'm just about to sleep, and my eyes go, boom. And you may relate to this, and my hearing becomes very sensitive. And basically what I've done is just scare the heck out of myself before I go to sleep. Now I can't go to sleep, because I'm the only one scaring me. You know, if you came up to me and you shamed me today, I'd probably say something right back and say, hey, that's offensive.
And if you need to continue to do that, it's okay, but here's what I'm going to do to take care of myself. But I do it to me 100 times a day in my head. I scare me, but I'm just concerned. Nobody's scaring me but me. So when I got it that I'm the one doing this to myself, I began to recognize that I'm either going to love me and quit faking loving you so I can love you genuinely, or scare me and keep faking loving you and live in a fantasy world based on those fears. I had an opportunity to hear a wonderful man speak, and I read his book. His name is Daniel Brinkley. He died three times and was clinically dead for 23 minutes and talked about what it was like when love took place. And I'm not going to go into his story, but I heard him speak one time, and he said it with such conviction it moved my heart to tears. And I've spent, since I was a child, seeking to find out who I am or why the hell am I here. And he leaned over a podium talking to 2,000 people. But I swear he was talking to me, and we were in the back. And he said, I've come to believe that we are truly powerful, magnificent, spiritual beings. But he said it with such conviction, my heart sang. And for the first time in my life, my heart accessed and remembered the truth. And then my head wanted to dispute it. And I come to delight in that thing, that we are all magnificent spiritual beings. How could a God create anything else? Except the God of my understanding was made up of the characteristics of all the authority figures from my childhood. Because authority is authority is authority. Oh, God's upset with me. God, disappointed God. I'm going to be punished. I guess this isn't happening the way I want it to happen because I'm being punished. Like there's some major higher power that keeps score on a supercomputer. And okay, today you get the goodies, and oh yeah, you get blessings, and you don't, because you've been bad.
Yes, she has.
And yes, she has. We can vouch for that because this is Emmy Andretti, and she drives like Mario. And so if fear is not real, and I'm manufacturing it in my own head, and I'm living in a fantasy land, then what is love all about? And I've come to believe through this program, and through continuing to practice these principles in all my affairs, and the very next thing that I react to is my next affair, that I better go back to the first step and say, I reacted, I've got a problem. I don't care what you said or did, I still reacted, and I've got a problem. And if I don't deal with that, and I want to make it about you, well, I've just given up hope. At that moment, you are my higher power. You have the ability to control me. But if I can own it, that I react, then I've got a problem. What feeling drove it? Almost always fear. And I might cover it up with anger, but it's almost always fear. Then what do I really want? Why? I simply want you to love me. That's all I've ever wanted. I believe that's all any of us have ever wanted. And that love is not a feeling. Love has brought such tears to my heart at times. Love has scared me. Love has excited me. Love has angered me. It brings all of the feelings, and so does fear. So I have a choice to live in fear consciousness or love consciousness today. And I absolutely want to live in fear consciousness, and anything that stands in its way, I need to deal with, or it's going to control me. So recently, as Mary had said, we moved to Hawaii, and we went with a dream and a fantasy, a lot of support behind it, and a lot of people who loved and adored us and cared about us. And in the process, we lost our funding, and we lost the person who was going to support the project and pulled money back. Well, we all sent her in Hawaii, no family, no friends. No money and no income, and all of our resources gone. When we got there, we had no debt whatsoever. But within 6 months, everything went in the toilet. Now I'm sitting there on an night, 6 in the morning, screaming at God. I'm angry as heck at God. What are you trying to do? You dangle a little carrot for us, God. You know, you dangle, we come over here, we do what we think you want us to do. And it's like, all of a sudden, it's like, oh, yeah, okay, there's this big V right here, and I'm playing victim one more time. And I'm having a temper tantrum, and I'm 12 years old, and I'm not getting what I want the way I want it, when I want it. And I better take a look at why I'm here. And I believe that I had asked that anything that stands between you and me, God, and love, remove it. And sure enough, the money went, the home went, the identity went, the family went, the kids went, the grandkids went. Everything that distracts me and that I keep focused on was gone. The ground we stood on was not even stable. We had the largest earthquake in 100 years while we were there. It was the same size as the San Francisco earthquake and the Northridge earthquake. And I'm on my knees screaming, oh, now the ground's not even stable. What else do you want? And I thought, oh, no, I'm not asking you. I take that one back. So surrender. Level of knowing that I never experienced in my life, that I am more, not I'm not only enough, that I am more than enough. And here I am in this circumstance, but I get to look at it 22 miles of shoreline in paradise every morning. It's like, oh yeah, I forgot. Dang. Control, I have no control, and I had to surrender, I had to let go, I had to recognize that my identity is now in no way whatsoever based on things in my life, that I came here as a spiritual being. I have nothing, and when I leave, the only thing I'm going to leave with, and hopefully see a higher power that asked me one question, two questions, did you love? And did you love well? And my hope is I can say yes. I had to learn, and I'm still learning. But I do it a heck of a lot better than I ever did before because of this program. Because I have steps that teach me how to get back to love. I have steps that teach me how to recognize when I'm powerless, that a higher power can restore me to sanity right now in this moment and step in and love, and fear cannot exist in the same place at the same time. So while I want to resent you, can I love you? Now, resentment's my protection. But if I can love you, the outcome is going to be very different. Recognize it, that I can surrender to whatever the circumstance is to a higher power. That I can go to a fourth and fifth step and share the exact nature of my wrongs. And that the magic happens when I do it with another human being. God already knows. And my sixth and seventh steps, the sleeper steps that we kind of tend to overlook, but right there's in front of me on my sixth and seventh steps that says, okay, oh yeah, projection, expectation, self-judgments, judgments of others, fearing, anger, reactions, and a long list of other things. Okay, I've done my sixth step now, and I turn this over to you, God, and I say, no, because they're in my face every day. And if I indulge them, then I immediately edge God out, running the show, and I'm liable to pay a price for it, and so are you. Because fear doesn't only affect me, it affects you. It affects how I talk to you. It affects whether I can love you or not. And whether God can somehow talk to you through me and talk to me through you. That's why I need to come here. I need to hear what God has to say. I had an old sponsor who said, you pray this way. And you go to a meeting and see what God, how God answers, because you're going to hear God talk to you on earth. And I can fight that. My ego wants to play God. It's totally absorbed with my safety and survival. But there's nothing to survive today. So instead of being a terrified 12-year-old, I delight in being a 12-year-old with a zit. And other things, but which we won't talk about. Very light, but all and so do I make amends as soon as possible? Can I look at you and say, I am so sorry I said that. I was scared. And not have to be ashamed for saying it.
It's one thing to make amends, but there's this other part of that same group that just beats me half to death for, am I ever going to get it right? What's wrong with me? Blah, blah, blah. You know, a huge committee that just handles away from time to time. And then I can make amends, clean it up, and practice a 10th step, an 11th step, and a 12th step continuously. And the very next time I react, that's to practice this in online figures brings me right back to the first step. I reacted, so I am powerless. Whether I like it or not, I'm powerless. Or I'm already reacting. It's that simple. I want to fight that a lot. And so, as a result, I get to love my grandchildren. And I get to love my children. And my kids who were terrified of me and my rage and my violence at one time. They're all good friends. My good friends today. And they fight to when I want to step into being their parent, they fight me on that because I'm not their parent. That quit when I was about 14 years old. Today they're my friends. God has no grandchildren. How can I keep them below me and God somehow? We are equal. And, can I look at this woman? You know, we've all seen movies. We've all seen. You ever heard love songs? And so many of them are codependent. Country western music. Most codependent music. Oh, I love country western. God, it's so good. I know that I'm looking with my horse on the ridge. I'm too visually oriented. That's just great. Where did I go? All my kids. They are my friends. They are my dearest friends. And I love being with them. I had seen and heard and read about how people who have been married for a long time learn to love one another more than they did the day before. And I thought that was impossible. I couldn't last. My record was 5 years of marriage. And today I learned to love this woman, Mary. When I saw her this morning, my heart jumped, my eyes danced, and I went, God, I love this woman more than yesterday. And it's been 25 years. It started this week 25 years ago. CODA's started this week 21 years ago. So the synchronicity and the timing of us being here is just such a blessing. And I'm grateful that you take time to hear me because I was not heard as a child. At least you listen. You may not hear me. That's okay. Yeah. At least you listen. That means more to me than anything in the world. Nobody heard me. That's why I raged. I had to get loud enough that somebody might pay attention. And then they said, no, we're not going to, you're going away. So nobody's running out the door today or running away from me, thank God. I believe codependence is such a new idea, a new spiritual concept, that we are all pioneers. We're all just beginning to figure out what this is about. I mean, we're learning more and more every day, but I mean, codependence in its idea is only about 25 to 30 years old. before that, it was just considered insanity. So now we have a name for it. So fear doing insane, self-shaming, judging, but I'm fine. I'll close now. But I thank you. I'm so grateful that you all are here. I'm honored to be here. I'm honored to always to share this with you, Mary. I love you so much. It wouldn't be possible had it not been for this program. Because I couldn't find this in any other program. You make it possible. You being here. You are CODA. I'm not. Mary's not. We're all CODA. I hope we never figure out what that is, because the journey and the discovery and the exploring today is wonderful. It doesn't scare me. It gets better every day. So thank you for listening, and please keep coming.